Good morning. One thing Cheryl did not mention that's on your announcement sheet is that Michael Tacey will be speaking next week. I don't know if you have a topic yet, Michael, but I know that whenever Michael speaks, people just come out of here just encouraged, and you bring humor to your messages and everything else. So I know whatever it is you'll talk about, it'll be great. So look forward to next Sunday with Michael Tacey speaking and providing the music. You'll just run the whole thing. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you. And then in February, as you see in the announcement sheet that insert, the February message series is Black History Month and Oscar-worthy films. And I'll be looking at three Oscar-worthy 2017 black films. They engage us in some challenging ways, but in some entertaining ways. And all three films can be found online via streaming. I think 13th and Mudbound can be found on Netflix, and Get Out can be found on HBO. So I encourage you, if you would like, to take a look at those in advance of the services. That would be good. And then the Mudbound film, we will have a screening here on Friday night, February 16th, a movie night. So if you want to wait until then to see that film, that would be good. Now,
Friday the 16th. Yes.
My message series this month, if you know, has been Overlooked Forms of Discrimination. And 2 weeks ago, we looked at ageism, and last week, we looked at ableism. And as Cheryl discussed with the children this morning, today's topic is educationism. Now, there was a young man by the name of Bennett Brown who graduated from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in 1994 with a major in physics and had a 5.0 grade point average. And as he pondered after his graduation, there were obviously, for someone like him, numerous high-paying jobs available to him, including ones in artificial intelligence and cancer research or nuclear physics. But 2 years after his graduation, he was, however, working in the south side of Chicago as a science teacher in the DuSable High School. His pay was just a little over $30,000 a year. He could not afford a car, so he biked to work, and he lived in a $750 a month apartment. Now, DuSable High School in the south side of Chicago has 1,400 students, and it's majority African American, most of whom live in nearby subsidized housing projects. And on any given day, however, only 70% or less show up for school, and those who do are often late. And Bennett Brown was the school's only certified teacher in physics and chemistry, and DuSable High School was lucky to have him. In the U.S., only 40% of inner-city schools have a certified science teacher. Now, Brown oversaw a classroom and a lab with few supplies or materials. He worked an over 60-hour-plus work week. But he wasn't just a school teacher. He involved himself in the community, running an after-school program for gifted fourth graders, and he mentored a graduate of DuSable who was admitted to the University of Illinois, but nevertheless struggling to keep up. But as Bennett said, his work was a form of activism. He was not a South Side Chicago community organizer in the mold of Barack Obama, who did work in the South Side as a community organizer, but he was working toward the same goal. He said, quote, "We live in a country where the economic class you become as an adult is defined by who your parents are. Economic mobility is predominantly a lie," Brown said. "I was born with quite a bit of privilege. I feel I have an opportunity to spread that privilege. Just by teaching, you give back. But if I were to teach in a wealthy school, who would I give back to? I'm acting to change the balance of power," end quote. And my message series this month, as I said, is overlooked discrimination. And we've already looked at two, as I said, ageism and ableism. And today I focus on educationism, which I define in two ways. First, educationism can be an elitist attitude, a form of discrimination or stereotyping that discriminates against those who are less educated. And our culture tends to believe that a less educated person or a less than ideal education is one's own fault. A person is either ignorant or lazy if they don't have a full education. And we saw this divide in last year's election when a large majority of those with high school educations or less voted for Mr. Trump, while a large majority of those with college educations or more voted for Mrs. Clinton. The other manifestation of educationism, which I want to focus on more today, is the discriminatory and unequal access to quality education. And our nation discriminates against children who live in poor or low property value communities, primarily because of how we fund schools. Most children who are affected in this way are minorities who live in inner city areas or rural poor who live in small and mostly impoverished areas. But one common thread in all forms of discrimination, as I discussed over the last 2 weeks, be it racism or sexism or ageism or ableism, is that they're prompted by a fear of those who are different. And with educationism, that's also true. We fear those who are less educated because we unconsciously assume they're mentally deficient or culturally backward. Many people can also fear blacks and poor whites as threats to their elite privilege. Denying them access to quality education is a way to ensure they'll remain marginalized. And then for our society to salve its unconscious fears of people who are different, we isolate and demean and discriminate. With educationism, those who are less educated often feel guilt and shame. Studies show that the less educated lack self-confidence and carry a stigma that society has placed on them. And that can become, many experts say, psychologically constraining, since persons affected by unequal educational opportunity internalize stereotypes about them. And then they often make little attempt to succeed. People who have been unequally educated have poor health, fewer job opportunities, and lower incomes. And that situation becomes a vicious cycle from one generation to the next. Low education causes poverty, which in turn causes children from low-income families to repeat the same cycle. Our culture seems to worship the Horatio Alger myth, that those who study and work hard in life will succeed. The poor are just lazy. They don't study or work. And this myth is based on the idea that everybody has an equal opportunity to learn in well-funded schools staffed by well-trained teachers. But of course, as most of us know, that too is a myth. A recent study in the city of Chicago of 300 black and white first graders found that when students are given equal educational resources, small classes, and highly, highly skilled teachers, all of them realized comparable levels of achievement. In other words, a child's ability to learn and grow into a successful adult is not primarily dependent on how hard one works or studies. It's usually dependent on how much money is spent on that child's education. and most states in our nation fund public schools primarily with property taxes. And logically, children who live in high property value communities can then attend schools with ample resources to fund their educations. And that kind of funding system is in direct contrast with how almost all European and Asian public schools fund their school districts. The American educational system, therefore, is one of the most unequal amongst industrialized nations. The wealthiest 10% of school districts in the United States spend 10 times the amount per pupil as do the poorest 10% of school districts in our country. And so we get what we pay for. Virtually all students from the wealthiest 10% of school districts go to college. And only a little over one-fifth of students from the poorest 10% of districts go to college. And that unequal allocation of education funds is, as we also know, very evident in the state of Ohio. Despite four decisions by our Ohio Supreme Court that the way our school districts are funded, that they've ruled four times that that's unconstitutional, Ohio's school funding method has not changed. Ohio's leaders seem to lack the political will to change the system, probably primarily because those who elect them oppose any change. It's only fair, most people believe, that their property taxes pay for their child's education. And that's an understandable thinking. But the solution, however, is to completely untie school funding from property taxes. Revenue can be raised from income taxes, for instance, and then be allocated to schools on a per-student basis, thus ensuring that all children have an equal opportunity to succeed because there's been an equal allocation of resources for their education. And numerous studies show that students learn best when four criteria are met. One, they attend small schools. And the ideal small school is 300 students or less. Two, their class sizes are small, especially, it's said, at elementary ages. Three, they have access to state-of-the-art challenging curriculum. And four, they're taught by highly qualified teachers. And of course, all of those factors are determined by funding. Now, at this point, my message could easily veer off into becoming perhaps more of a lecture than a spiritual message. And of course, gaining head knowledge is important. But gaining heart and soul knowledge, I believe, is of far greater value. Our purpose as a spiritual community is not just to know facts, as I've just outlined many of them, but to feel at a spiritual level the consequences of those facts. And ultimately, I believe change in a society's laws and systems to promote equality, that does not happen until a majority of people change their hearts. It's been 100 years after the passage of the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote. And yet sexism is still rampant. It's been 65 years since Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision ruling that unequal educations in the United States are unconstitutional. And yet we still have unequal and segregated schools. 40 years after the Americans with Disability Act was passed, we still struggle with ableism. In other words, systemic change and the passage of laws against discrimination, often brought about by years of tireless organizing and activism, those changes, those laws, those changes in our systems do create better conditions for the marginalized. But they usually don't change, or have often not changed, people's discriminatory attitudes. More important, I believe, is the unseen kind of change in human hearts and souls, the kind of change that prompts one to stop being self-focused and focus instead on empathy and compassion and service to others. And regarding educationism, a majority of people in our nation need the kind of heart change that the young man I talked about at the beginning, Bennett Brown, obviously had. Professor Fouad Ajami, professor at Princeton University, who's a well-known TV commentator, says that a politics of love and compassion, instead of current politics of legislated change, the politics of love and compassion is what's needed in our nation today. And he echoes a Buddhist philosophy of how real change happens. It must first begin in us. And Buddhism is often said to be the most equal form of spirituality. Everybody suffers, Buddhism says. But everybody has access to full enlightenment and what Buddhists say is nirvana. And Buddhism also says that the roadblock to achieving nirvana is our selfishness. We lament the suffering we experience, and so we desire things that will make us happy. Material items, judging or putting down others, or discrimination. When we step out of ourselves and the quote-unquote poor me attitude that we can often have, we move into a way of thinking that's empathetic. We begin to stop thinking, why do I suffer? To instead think, why do others suffer? And how can I help them? And I'm not against the activists and community organizers who push for systemic change in our laws and government. Barack Obama, for instance, is perhaps a great example of a community activist change agent who was able to bring about substantial good in our nation when he was president. But as we see, those changes are being dismantled daily, even today, all because a large number of people in this nation still harbor prejudice against immigrants and Hispanics and African Americans and women and LGBTQ persons. Indeed, political leaders can initiate change, but people from all streams of spirituality, be they including atheists, they can facilitate, I believe, a national reawakening of the soul. This wouldn't be a religious revival, but a revival of respect and kindness toward all. And that's why I find the story of Bennett Brown, that teacher in the south side of Chicago, so inspiring. He's presently working in Iowa City to teach teachers and develop curriculum for inner city schools. But his early years as a teacher and his continuing work in education are sacrificial. With his knowledge and skills, he could have made millions in another career. But he has purposely chosen to practice activism of compassion and love. And that kind of heart decision, one that denied what he might have desired, is one we can perhaps all aspire to copy in our own ways. How might we support equal education opportunities for all? How can we choose to deny ourselves in just some small ways? To volunteer, to work, or even live in a lower property value school district? How can we change the hearts of other people or our children to think and act as Bennett Brown? He's not changed systems or laws, but he's changed lives. And which will be more lasting and echo across generations? It's a question. A national movement that promotes compassion and love, I believe, is desperately needed in our nation. Far too often, people today demean and judge others out of anger or disagreement or fear. And of course, the dark side of humanity discriminates and stereotypes because of fear and selfishness. And as we've discussed this month, our culture then often demeans and isolates and shuns others as a result of discrimination. And we do the same for persons who are differently abled. And we do the same for the less educated, for blacks, Hispanics, and the poor of any race. Practicing selflessness in some way is the answer. To practice compassion, empathy, and self-denial doesn't mean we should give up our jobs and become a teacher, or that we sell our homes and move to another community. But it does mean we each have the opportunity, in our own ways, to deny ourselves in some big or small way to serve the needs of others. And I love that about this congregation. To serve and care for others is our collective commitment. And as we all know, each of our hearts has room for enlargement, to recognize our abundant blessings and then make those available to others. Our enlarged hearts, full of kindness and love, will then have empathy for the challenges of others. No more judgment, no more anger, no more fear, no more discrimination. And I wish you each much peace and joy. Now, as we did last week, instead of a talk-back time or a time of some individual reflection and meditation, I'm going to invite Brandon Weirs to come join me for a discussion, conversation on the topic of educationism. Brandon, come on up.
Are we talking live now?
I think you are. Okay. Are you on? Yes. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I need to have it a little closer, I guess.
You're good. Thank you for joining me up here this morning.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your willingness to do this.
Well, I appreciate being asked.
Oh, well, good.
Thank you.
Now, I think many people in here know you pretty well. And I was surprised, and I think it was such a cool thing when the gathering merged with Northern Hills Fellowship. Many of its members already knew of you. So you come with a wonderful reputation in all areas of this community. But I wonder if you would just tell a few people about how you got involved with the gathering.
The gathering was a spinoff from a previous association with Mount Auburn Presbyterian Church.
Yeah.
Where membership was attractive because a stated mission was the acceptance of gay board members in the session of that church. As a consequence, my wife and I left a suburban Presbyterian church and transferred there and followed its history through the development of a pastorate by Steve Van Kuyken, who then was defrocked by the Presbyterian Church in 1993 for wanting to perform same-sex marriages, formed a separate congregation, which was the genesis of the gathering.
Yes, yes. So you and Patty were founding members. You were essentially founders of that.
Well, I guess. Well,
along with a couple others, Sue Klein,
yeah,
and
we were charter members, not to forget the others that joined. There were all together, I think, 40 members of the initial spin-off group.
Yes, Yes. And then, of course, I came on board when Steve took another ministerial position, another church.
Yes.
And you were one of the instrumental people in that, because I had already moved to Florida and said, I'm moving to Florida. And you were one of the instrumental people in suggesting that maybe we could try another way. We adopted that schedule, which I do now, of 3 Sundays a month and 1 Sunday off. And
right.
Said we'd experiment, and here we are 8 years later, still working. And, of course, then we merged. So, thank you. I think it's helpful for people to know a bit about your history with this congregation. How some members of previous Northern Hills Fellowship knew of you is because of your involvement in area communities as an advocate for your school district, for your community, for children in this area. Can you tell everybody a bit about your work in that regard?
Well, there's a segue needed, I guess, because I took professional employment initially with Procter & Gamble in their research and development department as a trained chemist, and had to choose where to live, and wound up in Forest Park because it's near where I was employed, which was the Miami Valley Laboratories out west of the city near Ross, Ohio, and a lot of other similarly employed chemists and other kinds of technical people lived in Forest Park, and so we could carpool. And so I began carpooling with people, and then it included one in the neighborhood that invited me to become involved in public service, and so I did that in the form of a volunteer committee for the city of Forest Park, and then later ran for election in that city, and followed that with a run for election in the school board of the district that Forest Park is in.
Mm-hmm.
It was not until then, after retirement, which occurred in 1997, that I took up almost exclusively an interest in the education of young children.
Of young children. And you were on the school board for a while. You were Forest Park's mayor for a while.
That's correct.
And then, of course, you've been an active volunteer in the Forest, in the Wintonwood School District.
Correct.
You
that's
and Patty
correct.
Still are tutoring
that's,
regularly, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me some of the reasons that prompted you to become, as you said, on retirement, as an advocate for your district schools and for children in general.
Well, it's more for black children in general than for children in general.
Okay.
But it's also more specifically math and science oriented than other subject matter, because those are two areas of significant deficiency, as I was able to discover by studying trends in the district's performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a slide that shows, in a snapshot form, something that corroborates what Betsy Anderson talked about last week. In this table, there are data that are exhibited over the several subgroups of students that are classified by Ohio Department of Education, among which one is students with disabilities. And that is the second line from the bottom. And what's registered here is the departure from standards that were set by Ohio Department of Education of all the subgroups. It's a gap that has resulted over, in this case, 2 years compared. The 2012-13 year to the 2013-14 year. And the red line shows none of the subgroups met the standards for Ohio's performance. And the one that was the farthest from meeting the standards was the students with disability group. I don't know if you can read it, and I can't myself read it right now, but it's something like 57% only.
Yes.
Were able to improve on the gap. And so they all fall significantly below the standards. And the second least successful group is the black African-American group,
yes.
Which is, I think it's in parentheses, AA is the fourth from the bottom.
Yeah.
And, well, this is kind of a trend analysis for over 2 years, snapshot. If you take a longer view, that's shown in my next slide of what's going on in a district such as Winton Woods, which is, by the way, 65% African American, and economically disadvantaged, even a higher percent.
The Winton Woods School District.
Winton Woods.
Yes.
Pardon me?
It's 80% poverty. 80.
Thank you for that quote. that relates to another theme that I've identified. But here, for the moment, I want you to have a look at a trend analysis. The first slide was just a snapshot. This is trend analysis over several years, completed with the help of my eldest son, who's a professional statistician. What you see here are lines of linear regression, which rise over time if you're white. If you're a white student, that's the red line. And the blue line is that for African-American students. You see rising success in one group and flat outcomes in the other group. That's a result of that is the gap is enlarging, increasing over time. Mm. And if you don't find that problematic, it's for lack of seeing the data. Well, the school board district people typically don't put data out of this kind. What they do is tell you how many economically disadvantaged students there are in the district this year compared to last year, compared to the previous year. They'll show you a trend. Their business director, who's also director of accountability, would typically start a report card review each year by telling you what the latest economically disadvantaged number is.
Yeah. So
as a prelude to telling you whatever he wishes to about the performance data.
Yeah.
As if to say, this is why there's going to be bad news.
Yeah. As a scientist, as a chemist, this data speaks to you in ways that I think it can speak to everybody. But then as an individual, this data speaks to you about what's going on in terms of the inequality. And how has it – that's what's prompted you to get involved. Is that
I hope for this chance to tell you a personal anecdote and the rest of you, if I can get my – messages up here and my microphone in one hand at the same time. Patty and I were approached at one time to provide housing for a homeless black youth who had separated from his family from Brooklyn, and was living alone, wanting to finish high school in the Winton Woods district, and he came to join us in our home because we accepted the challenge of finding what might provide him with a complete high school education. And so during the course of the year that he lived with us, he had an encounter of the kind that led me to say yes to Doug. There was discrimination evident in his treatment as a black youth by his chemistry teacher. He said his name was Mr. Schode, as you recall. I sent him a prior message saying I think that was his name, and I think you had some conflict with him. And he said he was quite rude to me. This was his chemistry teacher. He would like to call on me for answers, and he didn't like my answers because they were over his head. You, meaning me, were teaching me things about science and chemistry, and I would relay them to him at school. He would say that I was not that I was wrong and not smart enough, and didn't know what I was talking about. At one point, he even started making comments that I didn't have a family and things. This was all in front of the class. And then he made a comment about me that I don't want to go further into. That was also rude. He said, you went up there, meaning I did. I went up there and gave the teacher an education in not only respect, but also in chemistry, and told and proved to him how wrong his teaching was and that I was correct in what I was telling him. That's kind of a personal anecdote. It's kind of self-serving, I guess, to point that out, but it's an evidence of how teachers' expectations can throttle ambition and quality intelligence.
As I said in my message, that one of the things that I love about the gathering at Northern Hills is there's miles to go for all of us to continue to grow and learn in our attitudes and in some of our own implicit biases. I know that I have them. But that in our own ways, we are looking for areas in which we can serve and which we can sacrifice. And I think what you and Patty have done, and you in particular in your work focusing on education in the Wynnewood School District, is just within your own community, trying to make a difference in closing the gap that you were just pointing out exists in our country. And you do that by serving your time and advocating for more equal access, more funding, all of those kinds of things. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
But one other thought I'd like to add along the lines of what might be done. We also have a watchdog group that's shown on the next slide, a publication from a watchdog group that required some research and some effort to put into print form. It's a booklet that's 18 pages, and I'm only showing the cover and the contents here, but you can see what subjects we covered. That was 5 years ago. It might be worth looking at that as another point in time 5 years later to see if what the progress has been, if any. But I would invite anyone who wants to become a member of the watchdog group to join my two other colleagues, shown on the next slide, and I in this effort. We have a five-year history of engagement and recognized by the school district for that engagement, and we'd like to have more people. This is a watchdog group. We also, however, have a hunting dog group. Watchdogs don't hunt. You want to know how other steps might be taken to improve things, or what other steps in support of teachers and students and the administration might be taken? Join our hunting dog group. It's called Winton Woods Achievement Boosters, Incorporated. And I have placed applications for joining us on the Leslie Edwards Memorial table behind the sanctuary. If you want, pick one up, fill it out, and send it in. You can join our watchdog. Or you can either join a watchdog group or a hunting dog group.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. So just bottom line, educationism, unequal access to excellence in education in our schools is very real.
Yes.
And you are working in your own way to address it, through watchdog and hunting dog efforts groups. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Dad.
No, thank you, Brandon, very much for your time.